K-Squid listeners, it's every other Sunday again, and I'm Ronnie Lipschutz. You're listening to Sustainability Now, a K-Squid radio station focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. My guest today is ceramic artist Jeffrey Downing, professor of art at San Francisco State University. He was featured a few weeks ago in the San Francisco Chronicle for his environmental sculpture in Richardson Bay, designed to mark today's king tides, which will be exacerbated in the future by rising sea levels. Maritime and canine themes are often present in his work. Hi, Jeff. Are you there?
Hi, Ronnie. How are you?
It's good to talk to you. I want to read a little bit more about you before we start our discussion. The Mission Clay website, which features some of his work, reports that Jeff Downing's sculpture is informed by the humor and pop sensibility of the California artist Robert Arnson, by the stripped-down economy of Alberto Giacometti's figures, and by the spontaneity and energy characteristic of the work of Pablo Picasso. That's a lot of shoes to fill. Downing's work with dog imagery depends on chance discovery of form, but seeks to invoke feelings concerning the human condition and our varied relationship with the natural world. In Jeff Downing's worldview, studying the dog, with all of its expressiveness, intelligence, and sensitivity, leads us to a better understanding of the connection between culture and nature. I want to talk later on about dogs as well. But as I said, welcome to Sustainability Now. Last summer, Oakland-based artist Marisha Farnsworth was a guest on the show. She works mostly with landscapes and environmental installations. Your work seems to be more about the placement and significance of the objects you create in various settings and contexts. I want to hear more about your history and background, but let's start with a basic question. How do you understand or explain environmental art? And do you categorize your work in this way?
Yeah, environmental art is pretty broad. It can be really anything. And I think, as long as humans have been making imagery a lot, when it involves nature, I consider that environmental art. It really as an art movement, it started in the 1960s with the land artists like Robert Smithson, with the spiral jetty. And it can be as broad as like land art, earth art, sustainable art. Even eco art, conceptual art, or social practice. I think that environmental artists, what they do is they make these great monumental works that are really outside of the gallery and the museum setting. And they also, not all, but most are trying to raise awareness of environmental problems.
So how do you decide what to make and where to put it?
Usually location is the first thing. If I see an environmental problem existing, then I would try to get an idea to see how I can raise awareness about that. First, I might see a place that's been disrupted by humans, and I'm inspired to make a piece to draw attention to that issue. Or I might even think of a piece first, and then have to go find the place to put it, find the location. Some pieces I make are portable. So I can take them to different locations. Some of them are sort of temporary shows that I may have been put up for just 3 or 4 hours. And I'll find a location where there's a lot of foot traffic or people around that would notice me doing it. And I'll put the piece up and draw attention to what's happening at the location just temporarily. And then I'll just take the piece up. So it's either location first or, with a problem, or I make a piece and take it to locations.
And how do you get the ideas? I mean, the specific ideas. We'll talk about specific ideas in a few minutes, but you know, what inspires you to come up with one thing or another?
You know, usually it's like, I think about like things like, you know, I'm working on a sea level rise project now, and it's really like how to draw attention to it. And I often think about like just the aesthetic, the beauty aesthetic that draws people's eyes to things. And a lot, you know, that works a lot in art. And just so people would notice something, like I think about like even, you know, really great graffiti artists that have a message in their work. But first it's like this kind of collage of letters and numbers, and people are drawn to it. And then the way they look closer, they learn to understand it. So I think it's probably aesthetic first, and then that draws in people to look at it. And then once they look at it, then they realize that there's an issue behind it. One example is, you know, with the sea level rise project that I'm working on now, I was looking at some exhibits that were put up, one in San Francisco at Marina Green, and it's an exhibit about sea level rise, and it's really just a pole with stripes on it and little dots. And I sat by that exhibit for like an hour and watched people just walk by, and nobody really noticed it because it was just a pole. So that inspired me to make something that was more noticeable first, and then have the cause behind it.
Well, let's come back to that one, that particular project a little bit later, okay? Because I do want to talk about it. Yeah. So you've now been a professor of art at SF State for 29 years. So what specifically do you teach there? And, you know, what do you hope to get from your students? What do you tell them? What do you ask them to do? I mean, how does that work?
Well, originally I was hired to teach ceramics, to head up the ceramics program. There was a professor there before me who was set to retire. So I was hired there to kind of take over that program. So I teach all aspects of ceramics, mainly sculpture and pottery, but I also teach glaze calculation, glaze science, kiln technology, kiln theory. I'm a specialist in atmospheric firings. Those are like salt soda firings, pit firings, raku firings, and then installations and beyond. I mean, I really teach anything. Really anywhere a student's idea can take the medium to a new direction, I'm all about that. I also teach graduate level critique seminars. I work with grads individually in multidisciplines. And this semester I'm teaching a undergraduate professional practice class.
Do you ask your students to focus on environmental art, or can they do anything?
No, anything, not necessarily. I don't really push what I'm doing on them at the time. You know, I do occasionally show slides of my own work, but it's not about me, really. It's about them.
Yeah, but you don't make them go out and look at what you've done?
If it's local, yeah, I mean, that could be possible. I mean, if I have something that they can get to. I show stuff all over the country, so it's not always possible for them to see it
sure.
live.
Uh-huh.
And then the second half of that was, what do you hope for?
Yeah.
Well, you know, mainly I want them to succeed. Like they're going to art school. They're you know, they really want to get a degree and have something come out of that. So they're looking for some kind of job or career or some way to make money as an artist, which is, it's a small field for success. But I try to get the most of them to find something that will really work for them. A lot of them come in and you know, they want to teach. So some of them graduate and they're teaching in K-12. I have students that have graduated. They're teaching at university levels with tenure-track jobs. Some have opened community studios. There's a number of them in San Francisco that are my former students that have opened community ceramic studios. And then there's some that are professional potters. And then studio artists and also community activists.
Well, that all sounds really great. So these are students who are pursuing a degree in a specific area, right?
Yeah, they're getting a bachelor's in art, studio art, and also MFA in studio art.
Well, yeah. So the biography on your website reports that you first came west from New York in 1983 with the proverbial guitar in hand, but soon gravitated to ceramics. I mean, what were you hoping to achieve when you coming out to San Francisco? And, how did you get into ceramics then?
Yeah, the ceramics thing kind of just kind of happened. It's kind of a chance thing. My, you know, my first creative beginnings were in music, and I was living in the East Village. I was, you know, I'm a guitar player and I was a songwriter, and I used to, you know, play on the street in the East Village, you know, solo guitar with a harmonica and everything. And that was actually a pretty good living. I could make some good money if I found the right spots to go, the time and the right spots to go. I met a lot of jazz musicians in Washington Square Park. I was exposed to a lot of street art at the time. Back then in the 80s, it was, you know, break dancers would just set up on the street. There were also like classical quartets, jazz musicians, saxophone players. And, you know, I also, I started seeing like art in all kinds of different art. Even though I was a guitar player, I started seeing art everywhere in New York. Some of the first street artists that I saw back then were like Keith Haring started there at that time, and he was painting his work on the sidewalks. And then Charles Simmons was making these dwellings things and like cracks and the bricks and stuff. And so I kind of got, you know, exposed to visual art as well at that time. I was, and then after I was in the Village, I started attending university at State University of New York at Purchase, and I was studying music. I was taking voice classes and music composition, playing guitar and piano. And then I had a like a break in my schedule where I needed to get a class, so I saw a ceramics class. And it was like, because I had the space open, I was like, I'll take ceramics. That ought to be fun. So I took that class, and, you know, it was really great because when I was studying music, it was always with other musicians with composition. There was always kind of like these debates on how things should go and how songs should go and how I should sing and all these things. And when I took ceramics, it was just me, you know, making a pot. And it just felt so satisfying to see, like, all by myself, like, creating. I was at that I went to that class, and then I decided to move to San Francisco to play music. And you know, I was a street musician in New York, and so I wanted to move. I picked San Francisco because a lot of my band, my favorite bands, I guess from the 70s, from high school and stuff, all came out of San Francisco. So I was like, I want to go there and see if I can make it, you know. So I just I sold everything I owned and moved to San Francisco with my guitar and the suitcase, and I looked for like other songwriters. I was writing a lot of songs at the time. So I started doing that, and it was really a chance thing that, you know, I wanted to be a rock star, so I'm trying to form a band, trying to play music, and working part-time jobs. But I had a friend who was going to the Academy of Art in San Francisco, and she encouraged me to apply to go to art school. So I applied, and I got in, and then I took another ceramics class with, you know, my first ceramics professor. His name was Bill Abright, and he really kind of changed my direction, like where he saw that I had like this talent with the material, and he started really asking me questions like, what am I doing with it? What am I doing with my talent? And so sort of pointing me in some direction that would, you know, kind of steer me into furthering my education and learning more about ceramics. I really, you know, started to love ceramics because he did. And he was, you know, he was fearless. Like, he would take us all to the beach and build a big fire, and we'd put a bunch of pots in it. I just thought that was so crazy. We were doing, like, these raku firings downtown San Francisco, and the fire department would come, you know, like, want to blow everything out. It was like, I thought he was so great. Like, he's such a rebel, you know. This is such a rebellious thing to do ceramics. So I just got hooked from that at that point on. So that's kind of how I got into it. It's like a chance thing.
Yeah, sounds interesting. I need to take a break, okay? You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now, as as Emily said, and this is Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Jeffrey Downing, UC San Francisco State Professor of Art. His specialization is ceramic and environmental art, and we've just been talking about how he got into the field. So, Jeff, that same bio attributes much of your later interest to your early maritime experiences, which relied on looking and seeing in order to navigate along the East Coast. So, I mean, I take that as being an important element, right? Looking and seeing nature in order to sort of shape what you do. Can you tell us about those experiences and how they connect to or inspire your art?
Yeah, sure. I think, learning to see is one of the most important thing an artist can have. And from those early experiences, learning to see things far away and define what they are. My father was a sailor, and I had a brother and a sister, and we would go out for like weeks at a time on a small sailboat offshore. And our charge was to find markers and find things, so we knew where we were. This is before GPS, so you had to really navigate by charts and the compass, and even my dad, read the stars with a sextant. But we needed to find markers, we needed to find buoys, even landmarks on shore, like towers, water towers were important. They were all listed on the charts. So I really was into studying the charts and finding out exactly where we were. Most of the concerns was you want to know where you are, especially on the East Coast when you're sailing near shore, because there's rocks everywhere and there's shallow water and you don't want to hit those. So you need to see these markers. So learning to see those was kind of eye training for me. And the visuals became important in my work. Stripes and checkers, even lights and even sounds to some extent, like horns and gongs and bells. Those are all those things that those navigational markers gave off. And all of it had a meaning. Every stripe had a meaning. Even a horn, like how many times a horn goes off for how long, how many seconds. A bell, the sound of a bell. Those all had a meaning, and you could all read it from the chart. So it was like this code that you could read or hear. And it was all coded in to have a meaning. And that became important in my work, kind of the hidden code in my patterning and my colors and my stripes. It was sort of like this hidden code meaning that if you study it, you can understand it. Now, not everybody knows marine charts and everything, and I'm not really accurate to those, but just trying to encode messages in my surface treatments. And when I was first, one of the first sculptures I ever made was a lobster buoy. I was a commercial fisherman in New York, and in order to get a commercial lobster license, you had to design a buoy with some sort of stripe or pattern on it that was identifiable by the Coast Guard or whatever or other fishermen. And so I designed this simple yellow buoy with a black stripe, and I felt so good when my license application came back and it said, "This is your buoy," and I was like, "Oh, I have an official lobster buoy." And so sometimes that buoy kind of makes its way back into my artwork as sort of this icon of my first thing, my first sculpture coming back. I think, a lot of that came into my work even more when I started making public art, meaning work to be exhibited outside the gallery or the museum. One of my first public art sculpture exhibits was an exhibit in Key West, Florida, and it's right on the water. It's a national park that's called Fort Zachary Taylor State Park. It's a state park, and then I had to make sculpture there, but I wanted it to be seen by sea, since there were boats that went by. There were cruise ships, sailboats going by, because it's kind of the entrance of the harbor. So I wanted my work to be seen by sea, also by land, from people working there. So I sort of brought this kind of high visibility colors and patterns into the work there. It looks like navigational markers, not officially, but they would be noticeable from far away. And then even that, in that Key West show, which I participated in for several years, I started to think about the environment too, that I was working in, how my work was impacting the environment, how we kind of relate to nature, and also responding to environmental forces. One of the pieces that I had there was a piece that was a response to the Hurricane Katrina catastrophe, and I think it was in 2005. But the piece I actually made was a tall public art piece, but it had a moving, a turntable on top, and there was actually a dog mounted on the top of it, which was in the shape of a weather vane. So the dog actually moved with the wind. So you could tell, like, when the winds change, you could see the dog pointing in another direction. There was a compass outline below it. So it was sort of an indicator of storms approaching.
Huh. Well, we're going to talk about dogs a little bit later.
Okay.
So now your most recent project is Level Up, a sculptural view of sea level rise. And you created it during a residency at the Marin Museum of Contemporary Art. Are you still in residence there, or was that last year?
Yeah, I'm still here. I'm in my studio right now, and this is my last month, so I'm finishing up. My show was up from the second week in November, and it just came down right before that Christmas, right after Christmas time. That project, I was really interested when I came here to the residency. I'm still thinking about water and navigation. So I wanted to really do something about water in California specifically. And so I started thinking about, what are our water issues? Of course, drought is the biggest one. We've been in major drought for years. And then that was one thing, but I also thought about tidal flooding too, because we're experiencing sea level rise, caused by climate change, and everywhere in the world. And there's places here, and especially in Marin County, where I live, I see climate change affecting the sea level and sea level rise, exacerbated by the king tides every year. So, when I first moved to Marin, I rented a house that was on a small peninsula right on the harbor, and there was one day I came out and there was 12 inches of water in the driveway there, and I didn't really know what that was. I'm like, why is the tide so high? And it turned out that was a king tides, and so I really didn't heard of it before. This was years ago, but I saw king tides is a really great, people are kind of shocked by it, like, what is this? But they don't really know, some people have heard of king tides and they know it comes and goes, but they don't see it as like what it's showing us. Like the king tides, they're natural. They're not caused by climate change. They're caused by the moon and the sun being aligned with the earth. And they happen in this area, they happen twice a year. So, but they're natural. But when they do happen, they raise the sea level, the high tide level, beyond where it normally goes. And it gives us kind of a glimpse at what sea level rise will look like in years to come. So I thought I should make some work that I can put out in the king tides, and people will see it and they will ask, what is that doing there? Why are you putting work in the water? And I'm trying to show them and educate them about the threat of sea level rise that's imminent. I had already done a project about drought in 2 years before, so I always really wanted to do this tide piece, and it kind of keyed into my sailing days. Mostly, my sailing days was mostly fear of low tides, rocks and running aground. But I just wanted to start with, in the residency, start out right away. The first month of my residency was last year, 2020 of January, and that was the King Tides event. So I didn't really have a finished ceramic piece that I wanted to put in. So I needed to quickly kind of make something that I can go out, because what I first wanted to do was document, like, where am I going to put my piece and where is it going to get the most attention? So I made these wooden models, like with a cinder block on them, like these towers, that I took in my truck, and at the King Tides, within a period of about 45 minutes, I went and I installed them in the King Tides, took pictures, put them back in my truck, went to the next location, installed them, took pictures, put them back in my truck. So I did it in six different places. And really, I wanted to see, like, where would it attract the most, like, attention from people, from pedestrians or people passing by. And I really did find a good spot. And this is in Sausalito, Mill Valley, Sausalito. There's a path there that is a very popular path for bikers and joggers and people walking their dogs. And there, just hundreds of people are going by. So there was a really great spot, like a high visibility. And also people would stop and ask questions. And part of me putting the work in is like actually putting the work in the water with waders on. And people are like, what's that guy doing? Is this a science experiment? Or what? So, and And then I'm there to answer questions. And they're like, this is actually about sea level rise. And do you know about it? And do you know that this is a King Tides event happening right now? And so I'm kind of like, as an educator, I'm there, you know, talking about it. Let's see, I made those models. And then I had time to make the ceramic works, which are, you know, heavier, more cumbersome to move around. But, you know, the King Tides comes every year, so I had till next November, which is this past November, we're actually installed the ceramic ones in the bay and for the King Tides. And that's kind of what attracted the Chronicle's attention, was the ceramic ones, because they were there for not, you know, still one day, but they were there for longer. And that kind of the show of me putting them up is part of it.
Yeah, yeah. Can you describe what they looked like? Just for people who didn't see
like,
the
obelisk shape, like their towers are about 8 feet tall, and they're, you know, they're wider at the bottom and they get skinnier at the top, so they're like spears. The top of them, each one has a different kind of top, which sort of resembles a navigational marker. Shapes are almost made up shapes, but I'm thinking about markers, like what they look like, you know, that kind mm-hmm. of navigational markers are a lot like our street signs, like a stop sign has a certain shape, you know, it's a certain type of yield sign has a certain shape. So navigational markers are the same. So I kind of based them off of that, but I also I had my freedom to kind of make them whatever I wanted. Like it wasn't exact navigational markers, they were kind of my own marker shapes. And this particular installation has five of them, and I kind of place them about 3 or 4 feet apart, so they kind of stick up out of the water. They're based off of tidal gauges, so that they're striped like tidal gauges. They're black and white striped, and so as you look at them in the water, you can see the water rising and falling on the black and white stripes. And part of the work is that they reflect into the water. So when you see them in a high, water when it's not wavy or windy, you can see them, and they almost double themselves as a reflection.
Yeah, sure.
And with the waves, the waves kind of abstract them. So I've gotten several different, you know, photographs of them in different types of water, and you know it's you know quite beautiful to see them like that too. Even though they have this kind of purpose of, you know, they attract attention to people because they look good, and then. People go, I see what you're doing. This is about sea level rise.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, did you have to get...
was right before the museum show opened, and I brought some signs out there. One sign was about, like, what is a king tide and what causes it? And another one, you know, kind of information signs that I made. And another one was about what is sea level rise and what's the predictions of sea level rise, which is kind of shocking when people really see that. You know, most people don't really think about it unless you live by the water or live at sea level. You're not really thinking about it, but it's going to impact everybody because it's you know, the sea is going to inundate the land, and it's going to impact especially, you know, where I'm here, where I'm doing it. The biggest thing is going to be the loss of estuaries and marshland, and then also, you know, flooding of the roads, and it's going to cause traffic.
Did you have to get any kind of permission to do this from any authority or office or something like that?
Yeah, you know, I originally kind of was going down those channels and working, you know, with the county, and it was difficult to get all authorities. There was several entities that have to be on board with it, and it was really difficult to get, you know, everybody to approve of it, mainly because there's so many different jurisdictions. I mean, I learned that, you know, like, for instance, the path that I put it next to is the county, but when the ocean comes over it, it becomes a federal jurisdiction. So there was too much bureaucracy to get permission, so I just kind of did it, and I just took it down, and I didn't, you know, I didn't affect the environment. I didn't put it on top of anything or crush any plants, or I just put it right in the mud there. So I thought that was the best way to do it, because otherwise it may take years to get the permission. So I actually like just doing the quick exhibit too. It's like put it up and then take it down, and there's nothing left and nothing there, and nobody's worried about it. It's temporary.
We have to take another break.
Drive by sculpture or something.
Yeah, yeah. We have to take another break, okay?
And okay.
I have a couple of ideas I want to run by you after the break.
Okay.
You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Jeff Downing, professor of ceramic art at the University, San Francisco State University. We're talking about his most recent installation in the Marin County of what would you call them? Tidal measure devices, sculptures.
Yeah, tidal markers.
There's tidal markers.
On tidal markers, yeah.
So I had a couple of, you know, as I'm listening to you, the first idea is, you know, there's a trail all the way around the bay, and it would be really wonderful to be able to put a whole sequence of these markers along that trail. But that sounds like a lifetime of work. Go on.
I mean, it can take some time. I mean, now that I have the pieces made and I have the images of them installed, it gives, like, officials, like, a... you know, a better idea of what they're going to look like. You know, they really want to know exactly what it's going to look like and what they're going to have to deal with. Like, who would complain about that? You know, like, they have to deal with all those entities, right?
Yeah, right. And the other one was an art project that I had thought about, which was putting markers on people's front yards, you know, people who are near the water, to show them where the tidal line will be in 50 years or 100 years, which is sort of similar.
Yeah. I mean, those ideas I have going in my head to,
I'm going
to continue this work because I feel like it's really meaningful and, you know, about the awareness of it and especially people living by the water. I think they're more aware of it. You know, people that live in Florida, for example, they're definitely aware of, you know, sea level rise issues and, you know, even like the city of Miami, I mean, it's pretty much what, you know, it's adaptability. Like Miami has pumps all over the city to pump water out. Like when the ocean comes in, they try to pump it out. And so that, you know, it's kind of adapting at this point because, you know, it's going to be hard to stop it because it's happening and it's happening at a faster pace. So adapting to it is, you know, moving inland and then trying to protect the marshlands around communities because those are they absorb like storm surge and even sea level. Like if you take those away and you just build seawalls, then storm surge is just going to take it away.
Yeah.
And the natural marshlands are protectors of the land. So, you know, with that kind of awareness, I mean, communities are definitely working on programs to do it. Maybe too slow and expensive to keep everybody where they are now. People are going to have to, you know, move. You know, it's like the prediction is, you know, by 2100, the sea level is going to be, the high tide is going to be almost 3 feet higher than it is now.
Wow. Bio I quoted earlier, the blurb referred to your work as leading us to a better understanding of the connection between culture and nature. So how is that connection expressed in your sculptures?
Yeah, I think, you know, as humans, we need nature to survive. We need air, water, you know, we need land to live on. But at the same time, you know, we continue to consume it and destroy it and exploit it, you know, for profit. You know, destroying the rainforest, for example, or, you know, burning fossil fuels to cause climate change. I'm also referring to animals, too, when I'm saying that, is that, you know, with animals, too, we consume them, exploit them, destroy them. But still, you know, with animals, we forge connections with them. Wild and domestic. I'm thinking about like Jane Goodall's work with gorillas. You know, our domestic animals, our beloved pets, our cats and our dogs, horses, goats, other animals. You know, I think that those connections are important, and we really, you know, my hope is that by seeing those connections, we can, you know, help people understand, you know, nature and environments more. In my work, I think I'm trying to, you know, using animals as subjects, for example, trying to express that kind of things about animals that not everybody realizes. I'm thinking about a series I did some years ago called The Spirit of the Horse, where I had a friend who was boarding horses up in Northern California, and she had a young horse that she was that wasn't trained yet. So she had a whip and she was holding the horse and like kind of. And I said, "What are you doing?" She's like, "I'm breaking the spirit of the horse so we can put a saddle on it eventually." And horses have the spirit, like they don't want to be saddled, but all horses that are saddled, somehow the spirit had to be broken of the horse. It couldn't be wild. It had to be like forcefully domesticated. I guess we do that with dogs and cats too, you know, training them to live in the house. But it really, you know, I made a piece about that, like about the horse actually not having a human ride it, but it actually, its spirit rides itself. I have this ongoing series of dogs. I'm doing personifying human activities too. So trying to, you know, remind people of the connections that we have with nature and animals in my work. You know, through my environmental sculpture is a, you know, nature part. And then the animals that I make is a, you know, sort of the animal part connection.
Well, let's talk about dogs. I had that as something I wanted to follow up. So you've done a lot of ceramic dogs. And, you know, on the one hand, dogs are natural beings, right, like people. But on the other hand, they're culturally bred and socialized. So, you know, the dogs that we see when we're going for walks, do you have a dog?
I do.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, so they come in all shapes and sizes. And they've been bred, and so there's a sense in which they're cultural beings. So my question is, you know, first of all, what kind of dog sculptures do you do or have you done? And the second is that what can dogs, both real and ceramic, tell us about ourselves, that is, humans as similar beings?
Okay, yeah, I try to, you know, with my dogs, I try to, I make these series of, you know, life-size standalone dogs. I also do these narratives with dogs. And so what I'm trying to kind of relate to is like dogs, like for example, the narrative dogs with, and they're usually in a kind of an environment, an atmosphere or a scene. And really they're kind of personifying them as in human activities to show like emotions and tasks. And then like in the standalone dogs that I make, it's like about these like kind of things that dogs do, like dog waiting, dog guarding, dog protecting, even dogs loving, you know, like, in my statement, I say like how dogs have developed a way to communicate with us. Like they dogs, I think, especially of all animals, they've really kind of developed this way to communicate with humans and understand our language and communicate with us, and then give. And by doing that, we're connecting with nature. When they're communicating with us, we're connecting with this natural world through the dog, which yes is domesticated, but it's still, you know, an animal. And I think, you know, of all animals, humans connect with dogs the most. I mean, most people are, you know, who have dogs really find themselves like connected to their dogs, and that's nature to me. A dog is a natural being, and to some extent, cats and birds and horses and other animals too. But I think, you know, what we learn from dogs is, you know, like instinct and, you know, like other things are like, you know, to like when you think about dogs, like that. To learn to like live in the moment. Like dogs don't think about the past. Like they forget the past really, really easily. They're just living in the moment. They're not even living in the future. They don't know what that is. They're not worried about it. They're living in the moment. So I think that's really important to remind ourselves to do that too. And then, you know, also about dogs is like, they don't hold grudges. You know, they're not necessarily mad at you for very long. And they also like dogs, you know, they're okay being who they are, like in their own bodies. You know, they're not jealous of other kinds of dogs or what other kinds of dogs look like or what they smell like. They're like okay being just a dog. So it's a kind of accepting themselves. And then also, like, you know, one thing about dogs is that they seem to be like always loyal and dependable because they're, you know, naturally they're pack animals. So I think about my dog. It's like my dog thinks my family is her pack. Like, and she's really happy when we're all together. When one of us is missing, she knows one of the pack is like not there. You know, so they're like pack animals. And so I guess it reminds us to think about our pack, whether it be our family or our close friends. So really think about them and think about that togetherness. I mean, right now we can't have as much as we want, but dogs remind us of that, like how that is. And I think especially with dogs, it's like, unconditional love. Like, they just love you whatever, you don't have to earn a dog's love as long as you're there and they love you, And I found that with, the dog I have right now is a Chesapeake Bay Retriever. And I grew up with Chesapeakes because they're water dogs. And my dad, was a sailor, so he wanted to, initially we had German Shepherds, but they didn't like the water or the dock very much. So he researched it and found that what's the strongest swimming dog? It was the Chesapeake Bay Retriever. And I just remember, growing up in high school with the Chesapeake, that they were so loving, And I know all dogs are, but I especially remember the Chesapeake. So, later on I moved to California. I didn't have a dog for years, and my daughter were deciding to get a dog, and I just remembered the Chesapeake, and so we started looking into it, and, they're just great dogs, and it's the love, too. Like, I just remember the dog that I had in high school, and this dog just is full of love, so it's amazing. So that's what I think we can learn from dogs, like, just to kind of remember, like, just the moment of the day and playing and then... trading fear for love. Like, dogs can be fearful and, even aggressive if they've been treated badly. But, even rescue dogs who've had probably some rough times, once they're rescued, they can be, trained back to being, loving creatures again, They can trade that out. And I think we can learn from them, too, that they can do that and we can do that, too.
I want to take another break, even though we haven't been going on for so long, and then we'll come back and finish up the show. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM on your radio dial and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. Okay, you're listening to Sustainability Now. This is Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Jeffrey Downing, professor of art at San Francisco State University and environmental artist. We've just been talking about dogs, which is one of the topics that Jeff sculpts. And, Jeff, I'm not sure that everybody who does research on dogs would necessarily agree with some of the things that you said about, about memory and the future. But let's let that go for a moment. One of the things as you're talking, however, is that comes to mind is that we often say that dogs look like their owners, but owners interact with their dogs in ways that shape them, shape their personalities, their temperaments, to what the owner would like, right? And if you get a dog that won't do that, the relationship is never quite so good. This is not, I'm not asking you to comment on it. I was just reflecting on that particular feature. But I mentioned, the thing is, though, that dogs, I said humans are cultural beings, right? Even though we're biological. And dogs are the same way. And so I'm just a bit curious, how do you think, I asked you this earlier, but what is the difference, the distinction between that culture and nature from your perspective and in your art?
Well, I mean, I think culture is something that we've created as humans. We've created a culture around us, wherever it be, however we live, whatever we rely on to make that culture, like artwork, for example, is a cultural thing, or, where we live, how we live. I think, animals don't necessarily create that for themselves. They live in the environment they live in. They don't build things or make things to make it better. They just live where they are. And I think that's something. And culture is also a way we communicate with each other as humans through, you know, events or places that we travel to or things like that. So I think that's the difference. I think culture is, you know, human related, you know. You know, I think, I guess animals could have a cultural too, but I think about culture as human. You know, when I'm talking about it, I'm thinking about it as like our culture as humans, like our human environment relating to a natural environment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I was just thinking about how we relate to dogs versus coyotes, right? And the way in which coyotes, a lot of coyotes are products of the environment, the human environment in which they live as well. But we certainly don't have friendships with coyotes, whereas we do with dogs, and they, again, reflect the environment, the cultural environment in which they live. You know, this is, I'm just nitpicking here because I'm really...
I think it's because they were domesticated and it was successful. I mean, people tried to domesticate zebras, but they just don't do it, you know?
Right.
It's like dogs did it and they adapted to it.
Well, zebras didn't come around to the fire to get fed, right? That was the difference, right? I guess that was what it was. Do you represent variation in the dogs that you sculpt? I mean, the pictures that I saw seemed to suggest that most of the dogs were more or less the same size. Do you? And the reason I ask this is that, I saw someone mention somewhere that while 2020 was a lousy year for people, it was a great year for dogs. And I certainly have seen a lot more dogs out and about, you know, taking their owners for walks. And I find it fascinating that they come in so many different shapes and temperaments. And I'm wondering, do you represent that kind of variation in your dogs?
Yeah, I find that fascinating too. And I actually have seen a lot of owners or dogs with their owners from the window of my studio, like all day long, and they're going by. It's amazing, you know, how many different kind of dogs there are. And I think that's what really kind of got me on making dogs from the start. Originally, I think I was a figurative sculptor. I was making human figures, but I had an interest in abstraction. And you know, there were some artists that I was looking at that, you know, were able to abstract the human figure, and it worked. And you know, I tried and I did it to some extent, but somehow sometimes I looked at the work and it didn't work. Like I abstracted it, but it looked deformed or it looked off some way. It wasn't until I made a self-portrait with a dog that I made the dog, and I was able to abstract the dog, and it really worked. And I think the reason is because you can make a dog with short legs, and it works because there's dogs with short legs. So you can make a long dog or a tall dog, because when you look at all the different kinds of dogs, they're still dogs. So abstracting the dog became like really successful for me because it didn't change like what it was. In other words, like definitely, the variation is something that I like. Most of the dogs I make come from like their own breed. Like I haven't done a lot of really small dog, like portraits of small dogs. I haven't actually done a real dog. I really only made one, like a real portrait of a dog. All my dogs are abstract versions of a dog, but I do like certain types of, like the German Shepherd nose and, you know, the retrievers. I'm really into like the sighthound sort of slinky body, like long, lean bodies that show a lot of bones and muscles and stuff. So, yeah, I kind of take into a style that I'm making them, even though each one's totally different. I've made over 100 standalone dogs. And so looking at them, they really take on their character only at the end when I add like ears and the mouth. Like it's really, when I think about the dog, I had this thing I call dogness, which is really it's about like the face of the dog, you know? Yeah. And it's like, that's the temperament is like the face of the dog. And you know, it's all about that mug, the dog's mug, you know, how they smile. Or even with the mouth closed, they have like this face that shows the temperament. So when I'm making the dog, I make the body, But when I put the face on it, then it kind of comes alive and becomes its own thing. And then it's like, then, then I have a name for it all of a sudden. You know, but I can't name it before I finish the face. So I see the character and that temperament that you talked about.
Okay, well, listen, we're just about out of time, and so I want to thank you for being my guest on Sustainability Now.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So if you're interested in Jeff and his art, you can find out more by going to the podcast on ksqd.org, which will be posted tomorrow, and following the links in the blurb, and they'll lead you to various sites on the web. My guest on Sunday, January 24th, will be California State Senator John Laird, who has just begun his term in office. He represents Senate District 17, which includes Santa Cruz and San Luis Obispo counties in their entirety, as well as portions of Monterey and Santa Clara counties. Laird's political career began in 1981 on the Santa Cruz City Council, and it included stints in the State Assembly and in Jerry Brown's second administration. We're going to talk about energy, environment, and similar issues of import for California, and maybe something about national environmental politics as well. So that's Sunday, January 10th, 5 to 6 p.m., right here on KSQD 90.7 FM and ksqd.org, streaming on the Internet. As a reminder, shows from the 5 to 6 p.m. Sunday slot are rebroadcast the following Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7 a.m. And if you'd like to listen to previous shows, you can find them at ksqd.org/sustainabilitynow and Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Pocket Casts, among other podcast sites. So everybody, thanks for listening, and thanks to Emily Dunham for today's engineering, and thanks to everyone else at the station who make KSQD your community radio station. Until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now. Do you think of the ocean as yours? Because you need the ocean to breathe. Every second breath you take is coming from the sea. We don't really know. We don't really